From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's time for Strange News, fellow conspiracy realists, our weekly segment that takes us around the world and often just off the edge of the mainstream map. Today, we're going to learn a little bit more about the odd effect Prince Philip's death has had in the Pacific. We're going to see that Clearview AI is back in the news. No spoilers. And we'll also head toward Iran, where the world seems to be inching closer and closer to, well, I don't want to say world war, but definitely the Cold Wars are warming up, I think is fair to say. What would you guys, agree with that?
It's not getting any colder.
Nope.
Yes.
No. Well, not politically, at least, but it is getting a little bit warmer in terms of temperature, which I am absolutely fine with.
Well put. We also know that temperatures in the Middle East may well be unlivable within our lifetimes.
Oh, God. It's true.
Literally and figuratively.
Literally and figuratively. If you guys are on board for it, let's say we pursue it in that order. We'll go to the Pacific first. Sound good?
Let's do it.
All right. So this story happens in the wake of the death of Prince Philip. Prince Philip, as you probably have heard, was a key player in the UK monarchy. He recently passed away April 9th, 2021, at the ripe old age of 99 years old. As you imagine, royalty has pretty good health care. And in the wake of this man's death, a lot of people were, of course, heartbroken in the UK. And a lot of people were pointing out various problematic things that Prince Philip had done in his virtual century of life here on Earth. But one thing that bears a little bit more scrutiny is the religion built around him. We're not talking about the Church of England, folks. We're talking about something that is commonly called a cargo cult. And Matt, Noel, I know you guys have heard of these before, right?
Yeah, I know. We certainly talked about it in the past, either on this show or another one, but I always kind of forget what it is. So I'm going to be on board for a primer real quick.
Well, right. I'll talk for one second. Then I don't know much about this one. I know that cargo cults a lot of times have to do with newer technology or civilizations with newer technology that will advance on their civilization. And a lot of times leave behind goods or leave behind pieces of machinery or debris or whatever it is that they leave behind from their new technology. And then that technology, since it's so different from the understanding of just the civilization that they've encroached upon, deifies it in some way.
Yes.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, Ben, but I think a lot of it has to do with maybe legends or lore or myths that exist previously within a culture that then that encroaching group symbolizes in some way, maybe?
Yeah, that's pretty close. So there is a cultural context, if not a specific mythical figure, right? Mm-hmm. Prefiguring the arrival of these outsiders. These movements begin in isolated areas of the Pacific specifically, and the cultural context into which these outsiders arrive is the idea of what's called the big man political system. In the big man political system, individuals gain social prestige through the act of giving gifts. So, you know, you've had a wonderful fishing expedition or something, you want to up your rep in your community. well, it's time for a seafood party. You know what I mean? Who can say no to that? This became exacerbated and entered a new era as we saw. It started in like the late 19th century, early 20th century, but it really took off in World War II, because as Allied powers were island hopping to secure control over the Pacific theater, it would land in places that had rarely seen outsiders, in some cases had never seen outsiders, and these outsiders would come along with airdropped supplies, military equipment, stuff that looked like it was literally from the future. You know, imagine we're all living on an island. We are probably subsistence farmers or fisher folk. And then all of a sudden, we're inundated with manufactured clothing, canned goods, medicine that we had never dreamt of before. And we're associating this in our cultural context. And we're saying, okay, who is the person giving this to us? Who is the quote unquote big man? And how do we propitiate, reward, adore this person, this figure? This brings us to an island called Tana in Vanuatu. One of the most popular cargo cults is from Tana. It's called the John Frum cult, John Frum. Sometimes he's called Tom Navy. The story is that an unspecified group of Americans landed on the island with cargo in World War II, and then became, in the minds of some residents of the island, a spiritual entity. Something kind of close, uncomfortably at times, close to being a deity. Often when you hear these things reported, there's a bit of othering about it. And I'm sad to say, there's a little bit of condescension in the press reporting sometimes, where you'll see a narrator of a documentary, or you'll see a reporter who knows better saying stuff like, oh, look at this. World War II ended, but the cargo cult's still here. It's so odd. They're building life-size replicas of airplanes out of straw. They're building fake radio towers, things like that. And I do think it's they're looking down their nose a bit in an unfair way, because obviously this becomes a religious practice. These are religious symbols at this point. The locals know full well that this airplane won't actually fly. They're just as intelligent as anybody else. But Prince Philip is involved. There are a couple of villages on the island of Tana that are part of something called the Prince Philip Movement. They believe that this Duke of Edinburgh is a divine being, and they associate him with a part of their mythology. So like I said earlier, there wasn't a specific mythical figure for all of these cults, but there was that context of big man politics. Prince Philip's different because they did tie him to a specific legend. You're right, Matt. I just didn't want to admit it until we got to this part of the story, and I apologize.
Sorry. I wasn't sure if that, well, because I wasn't even thinking about Prince Philip, because I was thinking about the, what is it, Tom Navy, or not Tom Navy, John Frum, Tom Navy. It's like a symbolic person that represents the group, maybe, or something like that. But I couldn't remember. Thank you for, calling me on it, or I don't know.
No, you're absolutely right. Is this person like a deity or more of a Manson-esque figure, like a cult leader?
Yeah, great question. Here's how the legend goes. According to the ancient folklore of the Yao-Nanan people, which I apologize for mispronouncing, there was the once upon a time, as all good stories begin, there was the son of a mountain spirit. This son of a mountain spirit traveled over the seas to a distant land. And when he arrived at this distant land, he married a powerful woman. And in time, he would return to the native people on this island of Tana. He was sometimes said to be the brother of John Frum when the Frum movement began. And some of the people who believe this tale believe that Prince Philip is literally that son of a mountain spirit because he is from far away and he married Queen Elizabeth II. It's not clear exactly when this came about. Experts guess as early as the 1950s, so after World War II. We know that when the royal couple visited Vanuatu in 1974, a few people were actually able to see Prince Philip from a distance. And there are photographs of this meeting, which some folks may find offensive at this time. And Prince Philip, by the way, should be said, without editorializing, he leaned into this. He sent them signed official photographs.
What?
They sent him a club. He took a picture of him posing with this traditional club and sent that picture to them. He just gave them photos of himself to look at.
Ben, would you believe my inkling was right? We did this on Ridiculous History several years ago. The title of the episode, if you want to get a little bit more of a primer, the, you know, 30-minute primer rather than five or whatever, it's called The Duke of Edinburgh is Literally a God in Vanuatu.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you have to wonder, I mean, I don't want to read too many tea leaves of psychology here, but you have to wonder what it says about a person when they found out that people who really could use some secular assistance were worshiping you as a god. And then you said, dope. Here's a picture.
You're all like, oh, let me see. Let me send that.
Yeah, and we have to be sensitive here because this is the big story. This is something I was wondering about. This is actually the main thing I was wondering about when Prince Philip's death was announced. What happened to the Prince Philip movement? Well, it's still very much around. And although it can be tempting to look askance at this movement because it seems so very foreign to many people in the West, we have to remember this is a real spiritual value system for people. And the villages that followed Prince Philip in this way were stricken with grief and were trying to figure out how to commemorate his death. So as we record today, there are three rough possibilities that we found so far, and these may change. One possibility was some people said, look, this just solidifies it. He is definitely a god, and he will return like he did the other time back in the 50s. And then there's another group that is saying, we are going to now deify Prince Charles. So he will be kind of the spiritual and literal descendant of Prince Philip, now also worshipped by us. You can read some excellent reporting in the Telegraph about how this came to be, how the rituals are enacted, but I'm trying so hard not to read into these guys' character judgmentally, the princes, I mean. Like Prince Charles visited as recently as 2018, and he was appointed as an honorary chief. He dressed in a grass skirt and, you know, he took a bunch of photos. I imagine, they have, if you're royalty, you have so many photo ops, right? So I imagine this is maybe for them, it qualifies as spreading goodwill and a positive image. I don't know. What do you guys think? Where do you land on the ethics of that?
Well,
a little weird. a little god complexy, maybe, you know what I mean? Like, ooh.
There's if I'm trying to be completely objective, I can imagine a fascination with it. It would feel very strange, though. Maybe it's because I don't know much about the royal family. They seem to be somewhat deified already in Western culture, right? Mm-hmm. So I wonder if it's that different for them. Portraits of the royal family exist in, I'm sure, many households. I imagine it, but I cannot confirm that. I wonder what it would be like personally for, let's say, Prince Charles when he visited to go through that. And what you're recounting reminds me a bit of George W. Bush and some of the times when he would visit other places, you know, and he would do the things, the rituals, don the clothing of certain places that were very traditional, but it just feels wrong in a way when you're watching it as a third party. Because it is appropriation in some ways, but in other ways, it's just being in that area. But in this case, it's literally a cult that is built up around your family and or self.
Well, it's usually, I mean, it's like a diplomatic move if you're sort of like presented with the traditional garb by the government, you know what I mean? And asked to wear the thing or whatever. The God complexy thing I was talking about was more just Prince Philip leaning into this and signing pictures and all of that. That's odd. He's almost capitalizing on the fact that, I mean, really, some of these folks just don't know better. You know, I'm not there's no ding on anybody's intelligence, just about access to information. And he's essentially being like not telling them otherwise, you know?
Yeah, it's
a little strange.
Yeah, it's a sticky thing, you know, like the there is an ethical dilemma. Like, is it unethical to go along with the idea, or is it even more unethical to totally reject these people's deeply held spiritual beliefs? You know, like, God complex aside, it's I and many people listening today have been in situations where you are in a strange place and you are encouraged to participate in a ritual that might otherwise feel like appropriation if it were not made explicitly clear that these people, this community, wants you to be a part of this thing. They want you to do the thing, even if they think it's hilarious that you're really bad at doing the thing, which has happened to me a couple of times. If you can't impress people, just try to be endearing about it, and then you'll at least get a pity pass. The third thing that the Prince Philip movement is considering, which I think could be immensely powerful, is starting a political party. This could, I'm just thinking out loud here, but this could do a number of beneficial things for the people in these communities. I would imagine that they will have a special unilateral relationship with the United Kingdom that might help with infrastructure, that might help with, medicine, aid as required, especially as ocean levels continue to rise. So I think there could be something good that comes from this. For anybody who's listening to this segment who's thinking, yeah, I'm sold, I want a religious movement based around me. I mean, who doesn't? Sure. But Prince Philip had it really easy in terms of a lot of other cults of personality or movements built around a person. Because, you know, if you're a cult leader, the thing is, like, you're on call all the time until you get really big. You have to, like, you don't get days off. You have to do crowd work constantly.
It never stops.
It never stops. That's why we got out of that game.
So wait, Ben, I'm thinking about so what we've established is that there may be a religious movement forming a party that would represent, I guess, Tana or Tana, then they would have a special relationship with the UK. I'm just imagining the whole Hawaii scenario that Doc Holliday did such a good job discussing.
Oh, yeah. That was awesome.
Where the special relationship goes bad really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a possibility. Hopefully it's far less likely in 2021. But the John Frum movement is essentially on one side of this island, and the Prince Philip movement is on the other side of the same island. And the John Frum movement already started a political party. So they're following in some footsteps here. I am torn about this idea. I think, yeah, it might not qualify as life-changing or world-changing news, but this is an excellent example of what we always say and have said for years. The stories don't stop when the headlines stop or when the news cycle moves on. They're very real people who are going to feel the consequences or the memories of the death of Prince Philip for generations to come. I would love to visit Vanuatu. It's on my list of remote islands to visit, but I'm not sure how to handle this. And this is where I want to defer to our fellow conspiracy realists. What do you think is the ethical thing to do if you found yourself in a situation like this? Let's say you traveled abroad to a remote location, you met some people, you did some stuff, you go back to wherever you normally live, and then years or decades later, you find out that you are now a messianic figure. How do you navigate that in a responsible way? Let us know, 1-833-STD-WYTK, conspiracy@iheartradio.com. We're going to take a pause for a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with more strange news.
And we're back with another strange news. This is a good one. This is a follow-up on one we've reported. I believe we did did we do a full episode on this? I think we did, guys. Clearview AI. The controversial internet startup AI software developer company based out of New York. A gentleman by the name of Hoan Ton Thot is the company's co-founder and CEO. There was a really cool public radio story where a woman tracked him down to this weird half used office, and he very clearly didn't want to be found. The reporter who tracked him down had to go to great lengths to find him. And even as early as then, we were talking about the ramifications of something like this, what the software purports to be able to do. It's just like facial recognition software on steroids. They've mined, and it's all a product, again, of all this amazing information about ourselves that we just pump out into the ether for anyone to grab or scrape is the term that's used when it's applied to like software bots, I guess, that go through and literally just grab up all of this stuff that's out there, all these profile pictures, any kind of image associated with people's publicly available social media accounts and more. And the thing that differentiated Clearview is that they just amassed through just, God knows how many hours or how you even break that down of scraping this data, just an insane library of faces that they were then able to supposedly cross-reference to information about the people's actual identity. Their idea behind this is that it's a tool that's going to revolutionize law enforcement, for tracking down fugitives and criminals and things like that. And of course, immediately the conversation goes the way it always goes when it comes to some kind of, only use it this way technology, where then it's like, yeah, sure, it's only for law enforcement, but so are radar detectors and anybody, can get your hands on one of those, or like tasers or any other thing that's supposedly proprietary. When it starts, it eventually makes its way into the public domain. It's problematic because how reliable is this technology? Is it creating false positives? Do we really want to put this much faith in some sort of third party, kind of seemingly fly by night, at least from those early stories, operation? And well, they're not fly by night because they're still around and they're making the news again in not the best way. Essentially, there's a couple of stories tied to this update, one of which is that BuzzFeed News reported and uncovered that in the early days of Clearview, trying to get some, momentum, they gave 7,000 individual people from the representatives from nearly 2,000 public agencies free trial memberships to Clearview AI. And this is like direct to them, not even through the agencies. So BuzzFeed basically created a searchable table of 1,803 publicly funded agencies and the employees listed as having either tested or downloaded, signed up for the free trial of this tool. And that's places like state police, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, healthcare organizations, the Air Force, offices of state attorneys,
a podcaster,
exactly, and public schools. So,
I was joking. Sorry, that was a really bad not joke. Joking about me getting access to Clearview. I'm sorry.
You did get it?
No.
Well, that's the point, though. I think the point is that these invitations are pretty open-ended, and that if you had gotten access to one, you certainly could have gotten it, because these invitations went out without oftentimes the knowledge of the agencies these individuals worked for. And that's the problem. And all of this stuff was happened between 2018 and 2020. And there's some really good, there's an article on, like I said, this BuzzFeed News article where they talked to several folks who got a hold of it. By the way, when asked for comment about this situation, the co-founder and CEO Hoan Tan Thot said it was, quote, gratifying to see how quickly Clearview AI has been embraced by U.S. law enforcement. Yeah, okay, he didn't really answer the question. He had no comment on any of the other 50 questions that were thrown at him during this this press conference. But here's where it gets interesting. A guy by the name of Adrian Williams, who's the police chief of Wilson's Mills, North Carolina. That's hard to say. Wilson's Mills. He has many mills. And he said, I found the site on a law enforcement website last year. He just found it. I said, you don't have to be a cop to look at a law enforcement website. Right. I set up an account to see if it worked. And he said he tested it using his own personal photos just to see what came up. He says, I ran two known persons to see if they came back with any useful info. I did not think it worked the way the ad said it would.
It's strange, though, because this comes on the heels of an earlier report, I think it was just last year, where Clearview said that they were no longer going to sell to private companies, no longer sell to non-law enforcement entities, which itself was an announcement in reaction to another piece by BuzzFeed News. Someone at BuzzFeed News is keeping an eye on this. And if you are listening today, thank you very much. I'm grateful because we talked about this in our episode on Clearview. I just pulled up my notes from it in our episode on Clearview. I think we do a pretty good job making the case that there are too many problems with facial recognition for it to be legally dependable, I think. What do you guys
think? I completely agree, especially if it's from things like low light, security cameras or ATM cameras and things like that. I mean, I would certainly hope you could not convict somebody with that alone, you know?
Yeah, like you said, there are so many problems. Resolution of the photos that are being uploaded to it. You guys remember in that episode we recorded, there was a journalist who was being interviewed and they put his photograph in there, or they, they put a photograph in, and then they found, I think, a picture of him from some old like GeoCities site or MySpace or whatever it was of him when he was a little kid. And so somehow the facial recognition found him when his face looked completely different. So like the actual metrics of the facial recognition, could maybe be that sophisticated. And that's what the founder said. It was just super sophisticated that it was able to find you at that young age. But really, it seems like, I think we concluded even that there's probably some other things that are happening in the background of that search application.
Yeah, very much so. Because what we're looking at, I mean, this is proprietary, but what we're probably looking at is a pretty robust cross-referencing system. So it is an image search, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's also an image search that recognizes metadata in a digital image. The problem that I'm talking about, to say the quiet part out loud, and it's weird that more people don't talk about this, the problem with facial recognition is that it has huge systemic racial problems.
Oh, yeah.
If you are a Black person, or if you are pretty much any person of color, the majority of these facial recognition programs have a high likelihood of misidentifying you. And yeah, that can just be like, oh, imperfect technology when we're just doing R&D and people are trying to prove something works. But when you get, like Noel saying, when you get into the sphere of law enforcement, you're talking about real legal consequences. If there is a world where someone can be locked up or detained based entirely on facial recognition, then that world needs to have facial recognition technology that actually works. And right now, that's not the case.
No, Ben, I'm sorry. What you're saying too is, I'm saying this lightheartedly because it's just so depressing, but it's, you know, you hear so often the racist notion that all, insert race here, look the same. This is literally technology that has that problematic kind of like flaw. And it's a thing that police do quite often, mistaking a young black male in a hoodie for another young black male in a hoodie who committed a crime, you know, and not actually taking the time to ask the questions and find out if that person really was there. They just, you know, jump to conclusions. This is it's just problematic on so many levels. Not to mention the company, you know, kind of circumvent. I mean, I get it. I guess it's like the first taste is free or whatever. And it's like they're trying to get some buzz about it in the law enforcement community. But apparently these folks were actually using it to help them in their law enforcement efforts without the knowledge of their superiors.
Mm-hmm. That's the other aspect that just further complicates this. Like, one thing we know for sure about these powerful investigative tools is that whenever you have a group of people that are allowed to use them, even if only for official purposes, someone inevitably uses it to search for like a person they have a crush on, or the person they have a grudge with, or their ex-spouse or their girlfriend or something like that. Like, this stuff, without oversight, this is dangerous. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, guys, I want to see in the Supreme Court, I want to see a case rise all the way up to SCOTUS where it's an individual versus, let's say, a Clearview, where they're accusing the algorithm of cyber stalking them. See if we can get a felony or whatever, misdemeanor, I don't know what charge that is, against an algorithm for cyber stalking.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, when is the first non-physical thing going to be recognized as enough of a sentience or enough of a mind in court to be liable for legal consequences? So it's a weird question because, oddly enough, it relates to the idea of legal personhood. There's mm-hmm. been a movement for several years in Germany and other parts of Europe to have animals, higher order animals like dolphins or elephants, recognized as legal persons, because the move is to get them recognized and then grant them environmental protections. So I wonder what would happen, you know, if you could take, well, at first you'd have to, I don't think you could take an algorithm to court. You would have to take the creator of the algorithm to court, right?
Yeah, or some kind of AI, maybe, that's functioning with it. At least you're right. Right now, yes. But who knows, man, it's the future. Take an AI to court, sue the pants. Wait, you could sue the RAM bits off of them. No.
The bytes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. What is it? That's the way I'm going to say, Mr. Showline. We'll sue the pants off of them, and then we'll sell them pants. I bring up Mr. Show, the seminal HBO sketch comedy show, kind of surrealist, you know, really cool. Like, each one kind of blends into the other one with Bob Odenkirk and David Cross, because one of the guys in the cast of that show, a dude by the name of Jay Johnston, a dude who looks remarkably like him, was you know, seen in one of these FBI, you know, shoot us a tip if you see this guy pictures that they were circulating around folks that participated in the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. And it's just funny to me. There's a full view of this guy's face and another one with him in a mask, and it definitely looks a hell of a lot like him. And a lot of people in the comedy scene in LA have reported that it definitely was him.
Yeah, he confirmed it, I think.
Yeah, okay, maybe I missed that part. But my point is, this is a dude that's all over TV and has been for like 25 years. Plenty of pictures of him on the internet. How come they couldn't nail him with AI facial recognition software? Doesn't the FBI have this stuff? Why are they, you know, crowdsourcing this?
Because it just makes show fans.
It just makes me question like the validity of facial recognition software in general.
Yeah, I was going to say, you better give me definitive proof before I believe that that man was there doing that thing. And make sure it's not a deep fake, because it could be that too.
That's an excellent point. That's the other thing. Facial recognition and deep fake technology are evolving at the same time at a breakneck pace. So I think we're already very close to a world where the deepfake tech can fool or mislead facial recognition tech. Also, you can get really cool masks. A lot of protesters wear them now that will disrupt facial recognition technology. Mm-hmm. I don't have one yet, but I've got some trips coming up where I should probably look into that.
Yeah, you got that one cool one that makes your face look like a holiday fire, though. That one's pretty cool. Or like a spooky ghost, whatever you call it. Like, it's like a LED mat. I love it. I tried to get one immediately, but they were sold out.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, those things, that thing is great. My cats, you might have heard one screaming just a second ago. My cats hate it. They are not down with it. They like people to have the same face every day, which I think is kind of living in the past. And maybe with things like Clearview AI, we will see more normalization of facial disguise techniques. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I mean, I would do it right now if I could. I wouldn't be on this YouTube channel showing my actual skin face. That's gross.
Old skin face Frederick strikes again. Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing this to everyone's attention, Noel, because we see again, legislation is getting left in the dust. Legislation is being outpaced by technology. And there are quite literally not laws yet for the kind of stuff this sort of technology can do. And that's going to be increasingly important, and it's going to bear increasingly profound consequences in the future.
That's right. I think it's absolutely founded in reality, that opinion. And it's become something like where there's going to be a disconnect between, you know, federal law and just individual organizations or entities. For example, the LAPD has already outright banned its use because they already see the problems.
Wow.
So there you go. And there's a whole other thing. There's several things wrapped up in this. There's like an injunction. There's a lawsuit that's going on in Europe, basically trying to prevent this from ever being used in any way in Europe. But yeah, the big story is that all of these agencies were essentially using it without permission. Oh, and not to mention the fact that it sucks, that apparently it does not work very well. So yeah, sorry, Clearview. I'm afraid they've drummed up so much, you know, hype for themselves by, you know, edgelording that kind of slippery slope of police state. But I don't think it's going to pan out.
I would say, I would say that one reply to that, and I'm not trying to be precious about it, is we're talking about a gun that has a bad aim, right? But a gun with a bad aim is only a more dangerous gun because of that, of that problem.
Yeah, it's like they say a dull knife is more dangerous than a sharp one.
Yes.
I guess it depends on whether the human firing the gun has good aim or not. Because if the human has really good aim, but the gun has terrible aim, then a bullet's never going to hit the target. But if they've got terrible aim, and the gun has terrible aim, then you could be in real trouble.
Carpe diem, man.
I don't know what I'm doing.
YOLO. Let's go. Let's go outside. Let's get clear viewed.
It's happening whether you like it or not. So
yeah, it is. And it's going to keep happening. And it's an ongoing story. And you're right, Ben. It's like, you know, you can't put the badger back in the bag. So it's already out there. It already has been out there. I mean, we see it with Facebook predicting who's in your pictures. So is that so-and-so or whatever? I mean, we know this stuff exists. It's just going to keep getting better. The law just needs to catch up. You know, to me, it seems like it's almost like a cheat, kind of. I don't know. I could see there cases where it could be useful, certainly. Say, identifying terrorists who are actively going to, you know, hurt people, you know, in a particular moment. But it's a slippery slope, right? You can't use it for some things and not other things, right? I don't know. I mean, you should be able to. There should be, It reminds me of, like, I've been rewatching the new Watchmen, or the, you know, not new anymore, but the Watchmen series on HBO, and it kind of, you know, creates this world where police have to hide their faces because, you know, just knowledge that someone is police is going to put that police person's life in jeopardy. But they have this thing where in order to use lethal force or draw your weapon, you have to make a case for it to somebody who then unlocks the weapon for you. I don't know quite where I was going with that, but I mean, to me, it's like there should be the ability to use a tool in the right situation, but also not so many safeguards that it's not even worthwhile and it doesn't really help anybody. Because in the situation in Watchmen, when the person can't unlock his gun in time, you know, the moment passes for that to be a useful tool for that individual to protect themselves. So it's all slippery, isn't it? I don't know.
It's all very slippery.
Well, let's slip and slide our way into an ad break, and then we'll be right back with another strange news.
All right, and we're back. Hey, you guys, I've had an earworm all day and yesterday. Do you remember this song, Wherever I Go? Wherever you go, I'll be right there waiting for you. I forget the...
Wherever you go, I will be right there.
Okay, we're getting sued. So that song has been in my head, and I played it, and I don't know a lot about music, but I didn't realize that the person who made that song's name is Richard Marx.
Yeah. Ooh. I saw him randomly. Holy, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Really briefly, I randomly stumbled into his show in LA at the Troubadour. It was sold out, and I like made nice with the bouncer, and he let me in, and I saw Richard Marx. It just occurred to me that's who that was. Yeah, so sorry. Please continue.
That's awesome. Oh, no.
So stupid.
I don't know why the song was in my head, and I had this epiphany, like, that guy's name... If you like use his shortened first name, that is unfortunate.
Well, I mean,
you Dick Marks.
Chaos is an opportunity, right?
Yeah,
Dick Marks. There's a situation where that could work to your advantage. I got to tell you, Matt. This whole time, we're running a tight ship today, so I can try not to chime in too much. But this whole time, I was waiting with bated breath as you talked about your earworm, because I thought this is either really haunting my guy here, or this is going to be one fucking amazing segue.
No, it's not. It has nothing to do with Iran. Do you know why?
No, let's do it. Okay.
Israel appears to have left its Richard Marx all over the Iran nuclear situation.
There it is. That's why I messed with you, man. You got it.
Perfect and worth every wasted second, which I contributed like 80% of. So, my God, tell us all about these Dick Marx all over Iran.
Well, if this stays in. Oh, hold on. I'll give you a clean break so you can come back in if you need to cut all this.
Okay, no. Let's keep it in. Tell us, Matt, all about these Richard Marx on Iran.
Okay, sure. Okay. This is very serious, you guys, and terrifying. And that's why I think we're forcibly making ourselves make light of it. There's this place called Iran. It's in the Middle East, and there have been a lot of tensions with many, many other surrounding countries with Iran. A lot of it has to do with the ideological view of Iran, or at least the perceived view, the perceived political intentions of Iran, and the stated intentions of Iran at times. And they seem to oppose most of the Western world, and especially Western powers that have a stake in the Middle East, in countries around Iran. We've talked about Iran many times on this show before. I'd recommend some of our other episodes to get primers on that stuff, or literally just search around a little bit. You'll find all of the stories we're going to mention right now. It was this past weekend when we're recording this, the last Sunday, there was a, quote, terrorist attack reported in Iran at this place called the Natanz Complex. This is, it's in Tehran. It's a power plant, a power generation plant. It's a nuclear power generation plant where there are centrifuges. And it's really dangerous to have a power outage when there's nuclear equipment being run, centrifuges, all kinds of other equipment. Especially dangerous if it's if they've actually got rods that are generating power, and the and then the surrounding power goes out. We've seen that before. What can occur? Fukushima isn't the same thing. There is a lot of water that was being dealt with there, as well as damage from an earthquake. But anytime power goes out, you can, you know, you're talking about backup energy situations that are always at least second tier at best. So let's jump to reporting out of the BBC just to learn exactly what happened here. According to them, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, the AEOI, said that this incident had occurred on Sunday. It was involving the nuclear facility's power network. They didn't provide a ton of information about what exactly happened, like what happened to the power network, but they did say there were, quote, no casualties or leaks. Hey, that's great. It is a nuclear power facility. Because we know that can be very, very disastrous. Here's a quote. They were condemning this despicable move. The Islamic Republic of Iran emphasizes the need for the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency to deal with this nuclear terrorism. Again, they're categorizing it as a terrorist attack that occurred on their facility within Iran. And they also said Iran reserves the right to take action against the perpetrators. So that's intimidating, a little scary, and it just depends on who the perpetrators are. If it truly was an act by an outside player, let's say a country, a state that was not Iran.
Got to keep them perpetrated.
Yes. Yes.
Whoa. Whoa. I literally just got an email about the Offspring. Right when you said that.
Oh, really? Yeah, weird. No, I've riddled you guys' computers with all sorts of surveillance stuff.
Specifically, you sent an email about the Offspring, and then you quoted the Offspring. Uh-oh, it's an act of terrorism. Oh, God. Well, so let's talk about this site a little bit, Natanz site. This place has been in the news recently. I don't know if we talked about this on a Strange News episode or even mentioned it in passing, but it's something that I'm sure we mentioned to each other. There was a fire at this same site earlier in 2020, in July, I believe. I think it hit the centrifuge assembly workshop. So as they were building up to these new centrifuges that they just unveiled them, that they are functioning. They just turned them on in like ceremoniously, and the power went out, basically. That's what occurred.
Yeah, we talked about it amongst ourselves, I believe, but we didn't talk about it on air because a peek into the background here, folks. For more than a year now, we've got this big list of potential episodes. And for more than a year, there's been one called What's Going On in Iran? And every time I start digging, because I read about this stuff in my free time anyway, every time I start thinking, okay, we can make an episode now, and it will not be immediately outdated, something crazy happens. And we're like, oh, good. It's good we didn't record. Because then people would ask why we didn't talk about this thing.
Yeah.
So maybe one day we'll be able to do it, but we can't really do it justice yet since there's so many ongoing events. And Matt, you know my feelings about this. That site has been targeted for years. And it's pretty clear who's doing the target.
Yes, we started this whole thing with a ridiculous accidental bit about Richard Marx, and we made a very, you know, we made a statement about it, about a particular country, and we said that Israel may have been the culprit, and that's because there's been some weirdly public reporting, like statements, basically saying yes, it was Israel that caused this to occur. So according to reporting coming out of The Guardian, Israel apparently confirmed that it was behind this this incident, which occurred in the form of a cyber attack. So that is the way that the power was I guess, messed with and then shut down was through going through the network of the Natan site. And it's very strange. And there's reporting about this coming out from everywhere, from The Guardian to the BBC to US outlets, including Slate.
Yeah, that's right, Matt. So there are a number of issues here that come into play. There is a conspiracy afoot. There are several conspiracies. They're not conspiracy theories. One conspiracy is on the part of Iran to have nuclear power. Whether or not you think that leads to weapons is going to be up to your own individual perspective. But the fact of the matter is that this conspiracy is worrying to a lot of Iran's rivals and enemies, because the technology you can use to make nuclear power is the same technology you use to make nuclear weapons. It's only a matter of how many times you rinse and repeat your centrifuge process. The second conspiracy is the active conspiracy by the government of Israel, as well as the U.S., to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear power. And this means that whenever you hear about an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, however you feel about them, one of the first things you should do is check on domestic news in the U.S. and check on the domestic news in the government of Israel, because I believe that these kinds of attacks take quite a long time to plan. This is not something you come up with on Friday and execute on Sunday. There's like deep cover people planted in these things, different assets and operatives. There is a silent ongoing battle, and we only hear about it in terms of isolated incidents, like a scientist gets assassinated, right? Or like there's a fire at a given facility. But these are all part of the same fight. And when I heard about the recent disaster in Iran, I immediately started asking some questions myself and digging into this. The current government of Israel was quite supportive of the former U.S. president's handling of Iran, right? The last U.S. president definitely pulled out of the Iran non-nuclear proliferation deal, right? And the current president, Joe Biden, is changing up the signals. He wants Iran and the U.S. back in the deal, which the government of Israel very much does not want. So there have been accusations in the West that the Israeli government is purposely trying to sabotage the situation, escalating pressure such that the U.S. will be unable, or I should say the current administration will be unable to re-enter that deal or renegotiate, because Israel sees a nuclear Iran as nothing short of an existential threat. I hope I explained that without putting too much opinion in there. I think those are just the facts.
Dude, that's great. And it also, we should just mention here that, as you said, look at the domestic news coming out of Israel, because you will see that Khan, that's a broadcaster there, they cited some unnamed, you know, they'll do an unnamed source. Some unnamed Israeli intelligence source says the facility was the target of a cyber operation, an Israeli cyber operation. Then Haaretz came forward and said, yeah, it's, you know, it was probably an Israeli cyber attack. Then a defense analyst at the Ynet news site said, quote, it was reasonable to assume that the problem might not have been caused by an accident, but by deliberate sabotage intended to slow the nuclear race accelerated by the negotiations with the U.S. on removing sanctions. Even Benjamin Netanyahu said the struggle against Iran and its proxies and the Iranian armament efforts is a huge mission. So they all kind of started talking about it publicly, at least the news sources, as well as the prime minister and a defense minister.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. This attack, this most recent attack, occurs as talks between the U.S. and Iran are underway. Indirect talks.
Yeah.
But these issues are on the table. So It's also logical to assume that at least some factions of Israel's intelligence agencies or the overall government, they feel like there's a limited window of time in which to act. There is a ticking clock in people's heads. And when that clock reaches, you know, midnight or whatever, then in a very real way, their worst fear may come true. There may be a nuclear armed Iran. And to be fair to Iran, they have never stated that they want to acquire nuclear weapons. Every single official international statement you read from Iran will say they want clean nuclear power.
It's true. It's true. And they're pushing forward. They've at least stated that they're going to push forward to 60% uranium enrichment, despite all this other stuff. Despite of the talks, despite of the tensions, despite of everything, Iran's moving forward, at least according to the Wall Street Journal and people they're citing. So we're just going to have to continue watching this whole situation as we're joking around about it, but the situation in Iran hasn't really cooled down since I've considered myself an adult. So maybe it will one day.
And the sanctions are crippling the people. That's mm-hmm. that's one of the really, you know, it's an interesting part of international relations. Do sanctions count as collective punishment? You know what I mean? Are you punishing innocent people just because they happen to live in a part of the world that's run by a group of people you personally don't like or feel are dangerous? I'm on the fence, you know, because in some situations, sanctions are purposely made to only target the very wealthy, right? Like if you put out sanctions on Rolls Royces in North Korea, it's safe to say that's not going to change a ton of people's lives in that country. There will be a handful of people who are very PO'd about it, though.
For sure. Well, hey, I think we're going to leave it here, everyone. If you know anything about the situation in Iran, we would love to hear from you, and as well as all the other things we talked about today.
Yeah, and shout out specifically to my social media friends who are in Iran. Your experience and your perspective is invaluable. We would love to, I would personally love to hear more about this. Also, would love to hear from anybody who has been able to visit Vanuatu. And I would like to know how other people who are not members of the Prince Philip movement regard that movement.
Yeah, completely agree. You can do that in a couple of ways. You can find us on social media where we're Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook, Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. You can also reach out to us over the Apple Podcasts, environment, I guess. Leave us a review. We greatly appreciate a nice review if you get something out of this show. This is like literally the pledge drive week of NPR condensed into 2 seconds at the end of the podcast. Do us a solid. It really means a lot for us as individuals and for the show. And you can also reach us by telephone, can't you?
That's right. We have a phone number. It is 1-833-STDWYTK. Give us a call. You'll hear Ben's voice and some familiar other sounds. Leave a message. You have 3 minutes. First things first, tell us what you would like for us to call you. Can be your name, can be a code name, whatever you want it to be, as long as we can call you that on the air. And also let us know if we can use your message. Leave your message. Put the important stuff up front. If you want to say personal things to us, put those at the back. If you end up feeling like you've got way too much to say in 3 minutes, rather than sending a bunch of voicemails, we highly recommend and plead for you to, please, instead send us an email. It's really easy to reach us. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.